3:17, chapter 17. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 317, Latched. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, hello. I have a couple of newsy bits for you before we get to the Age of Innocence and our poor, beleaguered, harried Newland, who is back from St. Augustine. Ooh, and I have some newsy things about St. Augustine for you as well. So hang on for that. First up, I have some useful things that I found this week. Useful for the kitchen, which would be really actually very helpful little blog post on how to cook quinoa, which is so healthy for you, and you should be eating it. Also one called Putting Time into Perspective. If you have kids who are just starting to really kind of get their head wrapped around the passage of time and history, I think this graphic illustration of the passage of time would be very helpful for them. My kids were fascinated by it for, 15 seconds, but then it sinks in and they are able to refer back to it. So that was pretty useful. This is all under the general news part of the show notes at episode 317. I know that I've mentioned it before, but it goes by quickly. Windows phones, there's an app now for Craftlit, so you can get the premium content as well as the regular show on that. So now that covers Windows phones, Android phones, and iPhones and iPads. I am actively working on Dracula and getting Dracula, and I hope the Woman in White into the shop for Halloween for audiobooks with benefits purchasing. So that should be coming to the shop shortly. The Montessori link I left on the podcast. If you are a Montessori person or know a Montessori person, please share my friend's blog/website. It's, I think, very helpful. And, and if you're going to have a kid and you're kind of interested, like, what's the deal with Montessori? I think it's a really useful place to start because it can be kind of confusing if you don't know what you're looking at. Halos of Hope, the podcaster throwdown. We have a Craftlit throwdown group on Ravelry. If you are making hats, chemo caps, please take a look at the Halos of Hope hat drive, really, is what it is. It is always a good thing to do. Hitch, the book, patterns inspired by the films of Alfred Hitchcock. Recently, I think AMC was showing Vertigo and Rear Window, two of my favorites. And once again, I am blown away by the clothes in those movies. Edith Head was a genius. And I think you're going to like the stuff that's in the book Hitch. Sweet and Simple Baby Crochet. Book coming out. I think we will have a giveaway for that book during the month of October. During the month of September, our giveaway is for copies of Grounded, digital copy and signed copy. Those two copies will be given away at the end of the month of September 2013. And I just got the proof copies and I'm so excited because it's a book and it's a real book. It's a book and it looks like a book and it makes me happy. Knit-alongs for What Would Madame Defarge Knit? What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit? Are ongoing. New ones are starting every month. So do check the schedule that's posted at the Ravelry page for What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit. You can find out more about the fun patterns you can knit with the designers involved, which means you can ask questions if you have them, all over on Ravelry. Also at Ravelry, we have started a group for Grounded for the sock patterns that are coming out. The test knitters are finishing up. The sample knitters are finishing up. I'm starting to get these gorgeous socks in my hands, and my goodness, am I excited. The Grounded thing, I think I've mentioned it last week. Socks for all of the characters are going to be released on a rolling basis. Pre-order, you get the first sock with the book. And then we will be rolling out all of the rest of the socks over the next couple of months to create an entire ebook. There will be more information about how to get your hands onto the ebook very shortly. And the shawl thing, don't forget, go over to groundedseries.com/updates, and you can look at how you can share your patterns inspired by Grounded on our website and sell them there. Because why shouldn't you? I think it's a great thing. So that's what's going on with the knit-alongs, etc. for Grounded. Also, thank you for your help. I know I mentioned it last week. It was a last-minute thing. Baby Lily and Mommy and Daddy are all home together in New Zealand. Thank you for your support. And on a weird, crafty topic, my younger son has become obsessed with mermaids. All he wants is a mermaid tail. And there are lots of mermaid tails you can buy that are, you know, neoprene or swimsuit material, and they're $90 or $140 or $300. And that's not going to happen right now. So he's decided to tone it down. He wants to make himself a mermaid tail. Here is my question to you. Have any of you done this? And then the follow-up question is, and have any of you done this for a boy? I want to make sure we get a masculine tail. But I don't really want to make mistakes. If we're going to do this, I'm going to have to scrape it together to get the fabric to do this. But I thought I'd throw it out there and ask for any helpful hints or advice in case any of you have done this. He wants an actual swimming tail, like a swimming tail, not a pretty sit on the land and look cute tail. He wants it to work for him. So I thought I'd ask. And see if any of you have done any of that. Me, I am still knitting my, Dreambird shawl for my mom. And that got kind of sidetracked because of all of the socks that I've been designing and swatching for and designing and coming up with stuff for and things like that. Plus, Defarge does Shakespeare. Defarge does Chaucer, if you submitted a pattern, we've been a little delayed. We've been waiting for a couple of submissions that we know are coming, but have been necessarily delayed. There's been some drama and trauma, and so we're on hold. But it's going to happen. We just have to, you know, we have to see everything together to make sure that it works together as a book. And until we've got all the pieces there, the board can't make decisions about what to include. So I know it's hard to wait. It's really hard to wait, but it's going to make a better book. So that's what's going on with that. Okay, so that's really all the crafty stuff for now. Now we have films. A movie for you to watch. I have some very good friends from when I was theatering in New York briefly. And one of them has gone on to make a movie with Ali Sheedy and some other people. One of them, a very, very amazingly marvelous actress friend of mine from when I went to UCLA. So it was very exciting for me to see her in a movie with Ali Sheedy. But for you, it will just be a good, heartbreaking, heartwarming, wonderful, marvelous film made by friends of mine. There are all sorts of ways you can watch this film, and I am putting links to all of those opportunities in the show notes. The movie is called 10 Stories Tall, and it's available online in a variety of formats, all free right now for you to see. So that's very exciting for me to be able to share with you. The second non-Edith Wharton-y thing that I wanted to share with you is a book from, let me lead you down this path. A longtime listener and friend of the show, her husband worked with my husband's cousin writing Star Trek novels and other things, but Star Trek novels is how it started. And what, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we got into contact and went, wow, the world is a very small place. And since then, we have gotten a chance to spend time together in the same place at the same time on a number of occasions. Well, being the mother of a 9-year-old boy and a 13-year-old boy, it shouldn't come as any surprise that when Bob writes a book for that age group, I am suddenly very excited and very thrilled. This book is actually a combination of books. It's like a series that's all been pulled together into one complete book called Latchkeys Splinters. Latchkeys is the name of the larger series. Splinters is the name of this first collection of stories. Each one of the stories is written by a different writer. All these guys, they call themselves the Crazy Eights or the Hive Mind. They have worked together in various places, including Star Trek novels, but came together to write these stories. They've got lots more stories in them, but, you know, they're not going to get written if people don't go out and take a look. So please go out and take a look at this book, Splinters. And if you're wondering, why would I want to read a book called Latchkey Splinters? I will read to you one of the things off of one of their websites. It goes like this.
On a quiet, dead-end residential street on the outskirts of Omaha, Nebraska, sits an old house called Tanglewood. In its front yard, a large old ash tree casts its shadow across shrubs and flower beds and a lawn that have all long ago surrendered any pretense of life. But inside this house are the doors. Doors too numerous to count. Doors made of the wood from Yggdrasil, the great Norse world tree that stands at the center of the universe. Doors that lead to every time and every place that ever was or ever could be, provided you're one of the rare few with the gift, a child with the ability to step through such doors to the other side, provided you're a latchkey capable of becoming one of the wardens, the protectors of Tanglewood and its doors. Then disaster. Tanglewood's connection to the world tree is somehow broken, and many of its doors disappear, sent spinning out across time and space with no rhyme or reason, leaving behind only the flimsiest of shadows. Now the young wardens must find and return the missing doors, but many of them have splintered from the impact. Those missing pieces must be restored before the doors can be returned, and splinters can be anywhere. Assume any form, almost like they don't want to be found.
Yeah, I had fun with my recording equipment. You can read all about the Latchkeys and their exciting, thrilling, spooky adventures to places that were, places that might have been, and places that almost could be. The collection of the first 6 installments of the Latchkey series can be found at CreateSpace or Amazon, and all of that can be reached via links in the show notes for episode 317 of Just the Books and Craftlit. So I hope that intrigues you. I really, really like this series. I've started reading it myself, and I'm having fun with it. But then I have fun with young adult literature, as can probably be told by the fact that I wrote a book. And I'm very excited because today the proofs arrived, and I get to look at the book, and it's all like a book, you know? It's very strange to see it in person, live and up close like that, after having it be just words on a computer screen for so long. So, very exciting stuff. Latchkey Splinters combines science, fantasy, quantum physics, all the good stuff, and some really great writing from some really great writers. So, I hope you check that out. Of course, I hope you check out Grounded as well. And now, on to the Age of Innocence. First, I was remiss, I needed to let you know, Renee, longtime listener of the show, has sent me a link saying someone blogged about the Pharisees. It's the name of the blog post is Villains in the Bible, Why the Pharisees Are Not Your Bad Guys. So I'm putting a link to that in the show notes because I thought some of you are probably going to be interested to see what that is all about. And the other thing I wanted to share with you before we get to this week's chapter is I got an email from Susan, who's actually down in St. Augustine, Florida. She said that in 1880, so 10 years after this book was written, finally a decent hotel was built in St. Augustine, Florida. And the history of it is fascinating. She also, and I'm going to post what she wrote to me in the show notes, because actually it has more to do with the 1880s after the time of our book, but it's really interesting anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and post it. However, she sent some vintage postcard pictures of the area as well, and I'm struck by how much they look like the Mission Inn in Riverside, California, where I grew up. So that's kind of fun to look at. But she also sent a blog page about just how rural, I mean really, really rural, St. Augustine would have been in 1870. So I'm posting the text of her email, the links to this story about traveling in St. Augustine in the 1870s, and some pictures, these pictures that she sent, which are really adorable and kind of cute. So while in the house, Mr. Welland, surrounded by servants, talking about how he's roughing it, seems a little disingenuous at best. I think that there's probably some truth to feeling like they are really out in the backwoods, living on the edge, you know, wrestling crocodiles to get dinner. It wasn't quite that bad, but it didn't sound like it was all that far from that. So that was kind of fun. So thank you, huge thank you to Renee and to Susan and to Bob Greenberger for sending all this stuff in for me to share with you. I thought that was kind of fun. Okay, and now to our chapter for this week, chapter 17. So May and Archer had this moment where reality almost broke through, the light of honesty almost dawned upon them, and then they both kind of shut down again and went back to the way things had been. And that's kind of sad, but kind of not all that surprising. Well, now we're back. We're back in New York. Archer is back. May is still down in Florida with her family. And so we're back to his normal circle, namely his family. And then there'll be Mrs. Mingott and Ellen and the men who he is surrounded with. But, you know, we have met some other people outside of that core group, the writer Ned, who he's friends with. And we have seen him kind of make these forays out into the larger world. Well, today we're going to get some terminology that's a little out of our normal day-to-day these days. And the first thing that we're going to come across is a description of something that Ellen wore that's a black velvet polonaise. And the polonaise either referred to a skirt or a skirt and a jacket top. And in this case, it sounds like it was a fitted top along with the skirt. The top would have been very tightly drawn over the corset. In this case, it has jet buttons, so black buttons. And the skirt was, I think we kind of, if we're going to get stereotyped about it these days, probably like a little Bo Peep skirt, one that's open in the front, like a theater curtain over an underskirt or a bunch of petticoats underneath, that would have been a polonaise. I think it was based on a Polish national costume at the time, unlike any Polish national costume I've seen from this century. But I've put a link to it in the show notes if you want to go and do further looking for your own self. Ellen also evidently would have been wearing a tiny green monkey muff. I found this a little more disturbing. Evidently, a monkey muff would have had shaggy kind of monkey hair on it. I'm real hoping that wasn't real monkey, but I'm a little concerned that it might have been. And green, it would have been dyed green, I guess. So, yeah. But then I guess that's kind of what you spent your money on if you were filthy rich in 1870. Ew. At one point, Mrs. Mingott gives what is called an adipose chuckle. Adipose tissue is fat. So this is Edith Wharton giving a very concrete description of what it looked like when Mrs. Mingott laughed. And again, ew. Sticking with Mrs. Manson Mingott for a little bit, she will accuse Archer of kicking over the traces. This is a horse reference to a horse that goes over or crosses over the traces, the leads, the leather straps that the driver carries. So kicking over the traces would just be a sign of complete disrespect for authority. And later she also talks about taking French leave, which would be leaving without permission. So it's just another version of that same thing. And then sticking with the French thing, we've got a French, something that the French called a McFarlane. It was a cloak with a cape. Now, what this turns out to be is a cloak is actually the long, what we think of as a cape thing, but it's the long version that hits the ground. A cape was actually the shorter piece that went around just probably to like elbow height. And so a cloak with a cape that the French also called a McFarlane. I'm having a very hard time finding an actual picture or drawing of a McFarlane, but it looks like a cloak version of an Ulster coat. Now, an Ulster coat is a men's coat. Women could wear it too, but it's the kind that has the long cape piece that goes over, the elbow length piece that goes over, which would be extremely handy if you lived in an area where it rained a lot, because the rain would run down off of the shorter cape piece and avoid getting stuck under your arms and around your arms and on your sleeves. I think the McFarlane also had a hood. I am not positive about that. If any of you have seen pictures of this in costume books, please link to it in the show notes. I am very curious to see what this thing actually looks like. Ellen's servant, serving girl, maid, person, lady-in-waiting, Nastasha, she speaks Italian, and she seems to only speak Italian, and she keeps saying this thing, Gia, G-I-A, which, as far as I can tell, translates to already, or before, or previously. And it makes it's very strange. It's like in Spanish, I had a teacher who only spoke in Spanish to us. And we were, I don't know, second semester or third semester, something like that. And she constantly said, entonces, which is, and then, and so on. And it's more colloquial, the way she was using it, than it was literal. And I have a feeling that this gia that Nastasha keeps using is more colloquial than literal. So if you are an Italian speaker, and you have a clue what she is using this word for, I would be thrilled to know. So there's another one. If you know, please leave a comment in the show notes or email me, heather@craftlit.com, and let me know so I can share it with everybody else too. You will hear the phrase leonine, meaning resembling a lion. It gets used a lot, and I know it was also used in Harry Potter, in the later books. And so I wasn't sure how frequently people see this fabulous word used, so I thought I would just let you know. You will also hear about the Marchioness Manson. That is spelled Marchionesss. So it looks like Marchioness. And that is the name for the wife or the widow of a marquis or marquis, depending on where you're getting your pronunciation from. And our last underused word, underappreciated word, stentorian. To say something with a stentorian attitude would be to say it loudly or powerfully. It is a strength thing. And it's a really good word, and I don't think we use it nearly enough. So I'm putting it back on the lineup right there, stentorian, powerful. And on that powerful note, I am going to hand you over to Brenda Dane to read to us chapter 17, of The Age of Innocence, with more to talk about now.
Chapter 17. Your cousin, the Countess, called on Mother while you were away, Janie Archer announced to her brother on the evening of his return. The young man, who was dining alone with his mother and sister, glanced up in surprise and saw Mrs. Archer's gaze demurely bent on her plate. Mrs. Archer did not regard her seclusion from the world as a reason for being forgotten by it, and Newland guessed that she was slightly annoyed that he should be surprised by Madame Olenska's visit. She had on a black velvet polonaise with jet buttons and a tiny green monkey muff. I never saw her so stylishly dressed, Janie continued. She came alone early on a Sunday afternoon. Luckily, the fire was lit in the drawing room. She had one of those new card cases. She said she wanted to know us because you'd been so good to her. Newland laughed. Madame Olenska always takes that tone about her friends. She's very happy at being among her own people again. Yes, so she told us, said Mrs. Archer. I must say she seemed thankful to be here. I hope you like her, Mother. Mrs. Archer drew her lips together. She certainly lays herself out to please, even when she is calling on an old lady. Mother doesn't think her simple, Janie interjected, her eyes screwed upon her brother's face. It's just my old-fashioned feeling. Dear May is my ideal, said Mrs. Archer. Ah, said her son, they're not alike. Archer had left St. Augustine, charged with many messages for old Mrs. Mingott, and a day or two after his return to town he called on her. The old lady received him with unusual warmth. She was grateful to him for persuading the Countess Olenska to give up the idea of a divorce, and when he told her that he had deserted the office without leave and rushed down to St. Augustine simply because he wanted to see May, she gave an adipose chuckle and patted his knee with her puffball hand. Aha, so you kicked over the traces, did you? And I suppose Augusta and Welland pulled long faces and behaved as if the end of the world had come. But little May, she knew better, I'll be bound. I hope she did, but after all, she wouldn't agree to what I'd gone down to ask for. Wouldn't she indeed? And what was that? I wanted to get her to promise that we should be married in April. What's the use of our wasting another year? Mrs. Manson Mingott screwed up her little mouth into a grimace of mimic prudery and twinkled at him through malicious lids. Ask Mama, I suppose, the usual story. Ah, oh, these Mingotts all alike. Born in a rut and you can't root 'em out of it. When I built this house, you'd have thought I was moving to California. Nobody ever had built above 40th Street. No, says I, nor above the Battery either, before Christopher Columbus discovered America. No, no, not one of them wants to be different. They're as scared of it as the smallpox. Oh, my dear Mr. Archer, I thank my stars I'm nothing but a vulgar spicer, and there's not one of my own children that takes after me but my little Ellen. She broke off, still twinkling at him, and asked, with the casual irrelevance of old age, Now, why in the world didn't you marry my little Ellen? Archer laughed. For one thing, she wasn't here to be married. No, to be sure, more's the pity, and now it's too late. Her life is finished. She spoke with a cold-blooded complacency of the aged, throwing earth into the grave of young hopes. The young man's heart grew chill, and he said hurriedly, Can't I persuade you to use your influence with the Wellands, Mrs. Mingott? I wasn't made for long engagements. Old Catherine beamed on him approvingly. No, I can see that. You've got a quick eye. When you were a little boy, I've no doubt you liked to be helped first. She threw back her head with a laugh that made her chins ripple like little waves. Ah, here's my Ellen now, she exclaimed, as the portieres parted behind her. Madame Olenska came forward with a smile. Her face looked vivid and happy, and she held out her hand gaily to Archer while she stooped to her grandmother's kiss. I was just saying to him, my dear, now why didn't you marry my little Ellen? Madame Olenska looked at Archer, still smiling. And what did he answer? Oh, my darling, I leave you to find that out. He's been down to Florida to see his sweetheart. Yes, I know. She still looked at him. I went to see your mother to ask where you'd gone. I sent a note that you never answered, and I was afraid that you were ill." He muttered something about leaving unexpectedly in a great hurry and having intended to write her from St. Augustine. "And of course, once you were there, you never thought of me again." She continued to beam on him with a gaiety that might have been a studied assumption of indifference. "If she still needs me, she's determined not to let me see it," he thought, stung by her manner. He wanted to thank her for having been to see his mother, but under the ancestress's malicious eye, he felt himself tongue-tied and constrained. Look at him, in such a hot haste to get married that he took French leave and rushed down to implore of a silly girl on his knees. That's something like a lover. That's the way handsome Bob Spicer carried off my poor mother, and then got tired of her before I was weaned, though they only had to wait 8 months for me. But there, you're not a Spicer, young man, luckily for you and for May. It's only my poor Ellen that has kept any of their wicked blood. The rest of them are all model Mingotts, cried the old lady scornfully. Archer was aware that Madame Olenska, who had seated herself at her grandmother's side, was still thoughtfully scrutinizing him. The gaiety had faded from her eyes, and she said with great gentleness, "Surely, Granny, we can persuade them, between us, to do as he wishes." Archer rose to go, and as his hand met Madame Olenska's, he felt that she was waiting for him to make some allusion to her unanswered letter. "When can I see you?" he asked, as she walked with him to the door of the room. "Whenever you like, but it must be soon if you want to see the little house again. I'm moving next week." A pang shot through him at the memory of his lamp-lit hours in the low-studded drawing room. Few as they had been, they were thick with memories. "Tomorrow evening?" She nodded. "Tomorrow, yes, but early. I'm going out." The next day was a Sunday, and if she were going out on a Sunday evening, it could, of course, be only to Mrs. Lemuel Struthers's. He felt a slight movement of annoyance, not so much at her going there, for he rather liked her going where she pleased, in spite of the van der Luydens, but because it was the kind of house at which she was sure to meet Beaufort, where she must have known beforehand that she would meet him, and where she was probably going for that purpose. "Very well, tomorrow evening," he repeated, inwardly resolved that he would not go early, and that by reaching her door late, he would either prevent her from going to Mrs. Lemuel Struthers's, or else arrive after she had started, which, all things considered, would no doubt be the simplest solution. It was only 8:30, after all, when he rang the bell under the wisteria. Not as late as he had intended, by 30 minutes. But a singular restlessness had driven him to her door. He reflected, however, that Mrs. Struthers's Sunday evenings were not like a ball, and that her guests, as if to minimize their delinquency, usually went early. The one thing he had not counted on in entering Madame Olenska's hall was to find hats and overcoats there. Why had she bidden him to come early if she was having people to dine? On a closer inspection of the garments beside which Nastasia was laying his own, his resentment gave way to curiosity. The overcoats were, in fact, the very strangest he had ever seen under a polite roof, and it took but a glance to assure himself that neither of them belonged to Julius Beaufort. One was a shaggy yellow ulster of reach-me-down cut, the other a very old and dusty cloak with a cape, something like what the French called a Macfarlane. This garment, which appeared to be made for a person of prodigious size, had evidently seen long and hard wear, and its greenish-black folds gave out a moist, sawdusty smell, suggestive of prolonged sessions against barroom walls. On it lay a ragged gray scarf and an odd felt hat of semi-clerical shape. Archer raised his eyebrows inquiringly at Nastasia, who raised hers in return with a fatalistic, "Gia," as she threw open the drawing room door. The young man saw at once that his hostess was not in the room. Then, with surprise, he discovered another lady standing by the fire. This lady, who was long, lean, and loosely put together, was clad in raiment intricately looped and fringed, with plaids and stripes and bands of color disposed in a design to which the clue seemed missing. Her hair, which had tried to turn white and only succeeded in fading, was surmounted by a Spanish comb and black lace scarf, and silk mittens, visibly darned, covered rheumatic hands. Beside her, in a cloud of cigar smoke, stood the owners of the two overcoats, both in morning clothes that they had evidently not taken off since morning. In one of the two, Archer, to his surprise, recognized Ned Winsett. The other, and older, who was unknown to him, and whose gigantic frame declared him to be the wearer of the MacFarlane, had a feebly leonine head with crumpled gray hair and moved his arms with large pawing gestures as though he were distributing lay blessings to a kneeling multitude. These three persons stood together on the hearthrug, their eyes fixed on an extraordinarily large bouquet of crimson roses with a knot of purple pansies at their base that lay on the sofa where Madame Olenska usually sat. What they must have cost at this season, though, of course, it's the sentiment one cares about, the lady was saying in a sighing staccato as Archer came in. The three turned with surprise at his appearance, and the lady, advancing, held out her hand. "Dear Mr. Archer, almost my nephew Newland," she said. "I am the Marchioness Manson." Archer bowed, and she continued, "My Ellen has taken me in for a few days. I came from Cuba, where I've been spending the winter with Spanish friends, such delightful, distinguished people, the highest nobility of old Castile. How I wish you could know them. But I was called away by our dear, great friend here, Dr. Carver. You don't know Dr. Agathon Carver, founder of the Valley of Love community?" Dr. Carver inclined his leonine head, and the Marchioness continued, "Ah, New York, New York, how little the life of the spirit has reached it. But I see you do know Mr. Winsett." "Oh, yes, I reached him some time ago, but not by that route," Winsett said with his dry smile. The Marchioness shook her head reprovingly. "How do you know Mr. Winsett? The spirit bloweth where it listeth." "List, oh, list," interjected Dr. Carver, in a stentorian murmur. "But do sit down, Mr. Archer. We four have been having a delightful little dinner together, and my child has gone up to dress. She expects you. She will be down in a moment. We were just admiring these marvelous flowers, which will surprise her when she reappears." Winsett remained on his feet. "I'm afraid I must be off. Please tell Madame Olenska that we shall all feel lost when she abandons our street. This house has been an oasis." "Ah, but she won't abandon you. Poetry and art are the breath of life to her." "It is poetry you write, Mr. Winsett." "Well, no, but sometimes I read it," said Winsett, including the group in a general nod and slipping out of the room. "A caustic spirit, un peu sauvage, but so witty. Dr. Carver, you do think him witty?" "I never think of wit," said Dr. Carver severely. "Oh, you never think of wit. How merciless he is to us weak mortals, Mr. Archer. But he lives only in the life of the spirit, and tonight he is mentally preparing the lecture he is to deliver presently at Mrs. Blenker's. Dr. Carver, would there be time before you start for the Blenkers to explain to Mr. Archer your illuminating discovery of the direct contract? But no, I see it is nearly 9 o'clock, and we have no right to detain you while so many are waiting for your message." Dr. Carver looked slightly disappointed at this conclusion, but having compared his ponderous gold timepiece with Madame Olenska's little traveling clock, he reluctantly gathered up his mighty limbs for departure. "I shall see you later, dear friend," he suggested to the Marchioness, who replied with a smile, "As soon as Ellen's carriage comes, I will join you. I do hope the lecture won't have begun. Dr. Carver looked thoughtfully at Archer. Perhaps if this young gentleman is interested in my experiences, Mrs. Blenker might allow you to bring him with you. Oh, dear friend, if that were possible, I am sure she would be too happy. But I fear my Ellen counts on Mr. Archer herself. That, said Dr. Carver, is unfortunate. But here is my card. He handed it to Archer, who read on it, in Gothic characters, Agathon Carver, The Valley of Love, Kitasquatomie, New York. Dr. Carver bowed himself out, and the Marchioness, with a sigh that might have been either of regret or relief, again waved Archer to a seat. Ellen will be down in a moment, and before she comes, I am so glad of this quiet moment with you. Archer murmured his pleasure at their meeting, and the Marchioness continued in her low, sighing accents. I know everything. Dear Mr. Archer, my child has told me all you have done for her. Your wise advice, your courageous firmness. Thank heaven it was not too late. The young man listened with considerable embarrassment. Was there anyone, he wondered, to whom Madame Olenska had not proclaimed his intervention in her private affairs? Madame Olenska exaggerates. I simply gave her a legal opinion, as she asked me to. Ah, but in doing it, you were the unconscious instrument of what word have we moderns for providence, Mr. Archer? Cried the lady, tilting her head on one side and drooping her lids mysteriously. Little did you know that at that very moment I was being appealed to, being approached, in fact, from the other side of the Atlantic. She glanced over her shoulder as though fearful of being overheard, and then, drawing her chair nearer and raising a tiny ivory fan to her lips, breathed behind it, by the Count himself. My poor, mad, foolish Olenski, who asks only to take her back on her own terms. Good God, Archer exclaimed, springing up. You are horrified? Yes, of course, I understand. I don't defend poor Stanislaus. Though he has always called me his best friend, he does not defend himself. He casts himself at her feet in my person. She tapped her emaciated bosom. I have his letter here. A letter? Has Madame Olenska seen it? Archer stammered, his brain whirling with the shock of the announcement. The Marchioness Manson shook her head softly. Time. Time. I must have time. I know my Ellen. Haughty, intractable, shall I say just a shade unforgiving? But good heavens, to forgive is one thing, to go back into that hell. Oh, yes, the Marchioness acquiesced. So she describes it, my sensitive child. But on the material side, Mr. Archer, if one may stoop to consider such things, do you know what she is giving up? Those roses there on the sofa. Acres like them. Under glass and in the open, in his matchless terraced gardens at Nice, jewels. Historic pearls. The Sobieski emerald, sables. Ah, but she cares nothing for all these. Art and beauty, those she does care for. She lives for, as I always have. And those also surrounded her. Pictures. Priceless furniture. Music. Brilliant conversation. Ah, that, my dear young man, if you'll excuse me, is what you've no conception of here. And she had it all. And the homage of the greatest. She tells me she is not thought handsome in New York. Good heavens! Her portrait has been painted 9 times. The greatest artists in Europe have begged for the privilege. Are these things nothing? And the remorse of an adoring husband? As the Marchioness Manson rose to her climax, her face assumed an expression of ecstatic retrospection, which would have moved Archer's mirth, had he not been numb with amazement. He would have laughed if anyone had foretold to him that his first sight of poor Medora Manson would have been in the guise of a messenger of Satan. But he was in no mood for laughing now, and she seemed to him to come straight out of the hell from which Ellen Olenska had just escaped. She knows nothing yet of all this, he asked abruptly. The Marchioness laid a purple finger on her lips. Nothing directly. But does she suspect? Who can tell? The truth is, Mr. Archer, I have been waiting to see you. From the moment I heard of the firm stand you had taken and of your influence over her, I hoped it might be possible to count on your support, to convince you that she ought to go back. I would rather see her dead, cried the young man violently. Oh, the Marchioness murmured, without visible resentment. For a while she sat in her armchair, opening and shutting the absurd ivory fan between her mittened fingers. But suddenly she lifted her head and listened. Here she comes, she said in a rapid whisper, and then, pointing to the bouquet on the sofa, am I to understand that you prefer that, Mr. Archer? After all, marriage is marriage, and my niece is still a wife. End of chapter 17.
I don't know if the end of that chapter chilled you the way it chilled me, but Medora Manson has presented herself in this chapter as being kind of a scatterbrain and kind of a goofball, and she's dressed kind of crazy with all these different textures and looping bits and all of this stuff, and she's got this ridiculous guy friend, the stentorian leonine Agathon Carver from the Valley of Love, which is one of those, it wasn't really a commune. Well, I get maybe it kind of was. You know, there were all these artist colonies and writer colonies and kind of utopian colonies that were starting up around this time. And so he's one of these guys. He's kind of like an Elmer Gantry, only without as much class, which isn't bad. And so you think that you know who you're dealing with. You think Medora is just harmless and kind of funny. And, oh, I loved Cuba and, oh, in the old Castile and, oh, Newland. And, oh, but he'd love to join us, but I'm sure, you know, under the circumstances, blah, 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 blah. And she's orchestrating everything while seeming to be completely irrelevant up until that last line. And of course, Edith Wharton cannot, she has not yet, she hasn't been able to, she cannot tell us exactly what went wrong in Ellen's marriage to Count Olenski. We know it's bad because we know how Newland is reacting to it, but we don't know much more than that. So here comes Medora saying, oh, sure, it would be a horror, but think of the money and the jewels and the flowers and the homes and the this and the that. And she's gotten her portrait painted 9 times. And surely that's worth living a life in hell, right? And Newland is justifiably horrified. And of course, we're supposed to be horrified too. But then there also has to be that piece of you that goes, yeah, but what's going to happen to Ellen? She can't remarry. And we know how the law does not favor women, independent women, single women at all at this time. And her family seems to be messing with her. And then there's this kind of unspoken, spoken moment where Medora looks back at the bouquet on the sofa. And remember, this is a massive quantity in the winter of red roses and what was it, purple lilacs at the bottom? Gorgeous. A deep, rich colored, red, purple colored flowers lying there on the sofa, huge bouquet. And she says, pointing to them, am I to understand that you prefer that, Mr. Archer? That being, you know who those came from. That would be Julian Beaufort. You would prefer for her to be someone's mistress? After all, marriage is marriage, and my niece is still a wife. And it's like, wow, shot across the bow. That is a scary statement to have coming out of this woman's mouth. And now, you know, everybody's lining up. the firing squad is ready to go. And Archer is in the middle of this. So he's just come back kind of renewed in his passion and ardor for May. And he walks right back in to this. And of course, poor Ellen. I mean, my God, you can't be more horrifyingly trapped than this woman is, because we can't know what her husband was like. But, you know, if you let your mind wander, if you've ever watched a soap opera and you let your mind wander for 15 minutes, you can come up with some pretty horrible things, I'm sure. So, poor Ellen. So that's where we ended this week. And next week we will pick up exactly in the same point when Ellen walks in the room. So that's the fun we get for next week. I hope you have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.